All right, we have two more wonderful speakers this afternoon. Our next speaker is Deborah Mayo, who's a professor in the Department of Philosophy at Virginia Tech. She is the author of Error and the Growth of Experimental Knowledge, which won the Lakatos Prize for the best book in philosophy of science. She's currently working on a new book that she's about to finish on statistical inference as severe testing, getting beyond the statistics wars, and she'll be speaking to us on some of that work today, I believe. The title of her talk is Severe Testing, the Key to Error Correction. Please join me in welcoming Professor Mayo.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be back here. Certainly, this is a very timely topic. Every day we're hearing that science is in crisis, most often, in my awareness, statistical. People are producing too many facts that promptly disappear when others look for them. It was one thing when it was restricted to the social sciences, but now that it's started to spread to fields like medicine and genomics, bioinformatics, people got truly worried. What seems to have happened in some cases is that big data foist statistics among fields that were unfamiliar with some of the treacherousness of experimental design and statistical inference. In any event, people are getting serious about methodological reforms. We heard about several already. Some of them are quite welcome, others are radical. And my position is that we need to have a better understanding of the statistical and methodological, philosophical, and historical features if these reforms are to succeed. Now, one group, the American Statistical Association, decided things were bad enough that they ought to form this powwow made up of many leading statisticians to look at one of the most common methods that everybody loves to hate, significance tests. And they said, the statistical community has been deeply concerned about issues of reproducibility and replicability. And there's a lot of doubt, and such doubt can lead to radical choices, such as banning p-values. And I was invited to be a philosophical observer in their powwow. I wasn't sure what that role was, whether I was allowed to say anything or not. But the interesting thing is, about 80% of the discussion really was conceptual and thus philosophical about evidence and inference. And then there's like 10% statistics and 10% politics or something like that. And the result of it was people were invited to write papers, and I have a copy of my paper, but I'll give you when I finish. And along with that, they put out a set of principles. I don't know if you're familiar with them, six principles for using them. And my particular commentary I call, don't throw out the error control baby with the bad statistics bathwater. And I will mention some of the passages from there, and when I do, they will be in that burgundy color. So, most used methods, significance tests, are most criticized. And so I said that statistical significance tests are a small part of a rich set of techniques for systematically appraising and bounding the probabilities of misleading interpretations. This is from Birnbaum, Alan Birnbaum. And I call error statistical methods, you know, that use error probabilities. They're also called sampling theory methods, frequentist methods. So statistics, just to consider it very broadly, as the collection, modeling, drawing inferences from data to claims about aspects of what produced that data. And those inferences can always be an error, and so the inferences are to be qualified by a claim about the methods capabilities to control and alert us to bad tests or to erroneous interpretations. That's my view of error statistics. And here, the p-value, most people are familiar, but some not. This comes up when you're interested in testing the conformity of data with some claim, often called the test hypothesis or the null hypothesis, H naught. And this, by the way, is the definition in a paper that I wrote with David Cox. So we have a function, a test statistic, such that the larger its value, the more inconsistent the data are with this null hypothesis, which is often a no effect hypothesis. And its distribution is known under the supposition of the null. And the p-value then corresponding to any observed difference is the probability of getting at least as large a difference under the assumption of the null. Now, clearly, if larger differences than you got occur fairly frequently, even if the data were generated in a world where the null hypothesis is true, then it's scarcely evidence of an incompatibility, because it's commonly produced, even under H naught. Still, small p-value might indicate some underlying discrepancy, but that's scarcely enough to say you have a genuine effect, much less to say that you have a scientific conclusion. So this is testing reasoning. But we know that a statistical hypothesis H should not be taken automatically, right, to some substantive claim, H star, and to do so is to commit this fallacy. Okay. I want to say that I'm not keen to defend many uses of significance tests that have been lampooned for 60, 70, 80, David Cox says 100 years. In fact, I introduced a reformulation of tests a long time ago in terms of discrepancies or effect sizes that are and are not well tested. The criticisms are often based on misunderstandings, and consequently, so are many of the statistical reforms. So I'm actually forced to go back to things like p-values because some of those reforms are taken so seriously. Now, there's what I call the replication paradox for critics of significance tests. The critic says, it's so easy to get a small p-value, but how come they find it so hard to replicate a small p-value that others have found? Is it easy or is it hard? For example, some of you might know, in this reproducibility project in psychology, which was a crowdsourced effort, only 36 of 100 experiments were able to replicate. So is it easy or is it hard? I think it's an important paradox because what it shows is that the problem isn't with the test, but with abuses of the test. As R.A. Fisher told us a long time ago, it's easy to lie with statistics if you selectively report, but that's not the test's fault. You're abusing it. Sufficient finagling, called by many names, cherry picking, p-hacking, significance seeking, multiple testing, and their different types of biases may practically guarantee that a preferred claim gets support, even if it's not warranted by evidence. We can call those biasing selection effects. And there are procedures to adjust the p-value to take them into account, not always easy to figure out. The result is that the inference, I would say, had not passed a severe test. The requirement is pretty obvious. If a test procedure has little or no capability of finding flaws with a hypothesis, even if they're there, okay, then failing to find a flaw, finding everything hunky-dory and agreement with H provides poor or no evidence. this is the kind of agreement that's too cheap to be worth having, as Popper put it. You haven't put it through any kind of a stringent test. I say that such a test fails a minimal requirement for evidence, even. And I would call my own account that of severe testing based on error statistics. So these formal tools are there, but if they are going to be used, they have to be reinterpreted. I also would want to extend the reasoning beyond statistics. Now, looking at things through the severity lens requires reinterpreting probability and altering the very role. Typically, it's thought to be one of two. That probability arises to assign a degree of probability or support or confirmation in a hypothesis, or probability arises to ensure good performance in the long run. So that's the probabilism versus performance idea. Coverage probabilities, underperformance, a behavioristic view of Neyman Pearson. Okay. But if you think about wanting to use probability to evaluate severity or the error-probing capacity, neither of these directly captures it. I mean, the performance is a necessary condition, but not a sufficient condition. And that's why we have a lot of howlers that can be shown. But think about problems with selective reporting, cherry picking, stopping just when your data look good. These are not problems about long runs. They do influence the error probability, and they do so because we can't say something about the case at hand, namely that it's done a good job of avoiding sources of misinterpretation. This is the key to revising the role of error probabilities. I can't tell you how widespread is the view that if you care about error probabilities, it must be that you only care about long-run performance, and they forget that the most important thing is actually a matter of how they impinge on error probability. So the three views, mine being the last, in terms of when they would say a claim is not warranted for the probabilist, unless the claim is true or probable or gets a probability boost, is made firmer. There are different notions. Performance, not warranted unless it stems from a method with low long-run error. Probativism, it's not warranted unless something, a fair amount, in fact, has been done to probe the ways that we can be wrong about the claim. And if you assume that probabilism is required for inference, what happens is error probabilities can only be made relevant by misinterpretation. And that's what people do. But that's false. I claim that they play this crucial role for appraising well-testedness. And it's even crucial to be able to say that the claim is highly believable, highly plausible, but terribly tested. So I am separating those two tasks. Now, one function of severity is to identify when selection effects are problematic. They're not always. That doesn't mean we should dismiss them altogether. I define biasing selection effects when data or hypothesis are selected or a test criterion is specified in such a way that this minimal severity requirement isn't met or is incapable of being assessed. That's bad enough if I can't figure out what you did. Okay, so picking up on these alterations is what enables error statistics to be self-correcting. Suppose that in 20 cases of differences that you examine, just one is large enough to test, and that turns out to be nominally significant at the 5% level. The actual level is not 5%, but 64%. So this is from a famous book, Morrison and Henkel's Significance Test Controversy, and almost everything that's being said every day now is already in there, and much more clearly. In other words, they're saying the actual probability of erroneously inferring a result
is around 64%. It assumes independence, which we don't usually have. But the point is, your guarantee is gone. They were quite clear on the difference between the nominal, it's sometimes called, or the computed significance level, and the actual one. There are many more ways you can be wrong if you allow, for example, hunting or trying and trying again. Your sample space differs. So there's a very clear-cut difference. You report, the results would be difficult to achieve under the assumption of no effect or under the assumption of the null, when in fact such results are easy to achieve using cheating, even if H naught is true. So you're actually misreporting what the actual p-value is. It's not small, it's big. Nowadays, we're likely to see the test blame, as opposed to back in how the older days with Morrison and Henkel. And my view is that tests don't kill inferences, people do. Even worse are those statistical accounts where the abuse vanishes. And this is what I mainly want to talk about. On some views, believe it or not, taking account of biasing selection effects defies scientific sense. This is just one of dozens of quotes, and it happens to be from Stephen Goodman, who is heading up this Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford with John Ioannidis. And to his credit, as I say, he's open about his philosophy. He says, two problems that plague frequentist inference, multiple comparisons and multiple looks, or data dredging and peaking, is to adjust the p-value. But adjusting the measure of evidence because of considerations that have nothing to do with the data, he says, defies scientific sense. To me, this defies scientific sense. But it's very noteworthy, though, that technical activism, this is the term of Goldacre for the current meta-methodology, isn't free of philosophy of statistics. Ben Goldacre, in a 2016 Nature article, is puzzled why bad statistics is still occurring even in the face of all this technical activism. And he says, the editors at Annals of Internal Medicine repeatedly argue it's acceptable to identify the pre-specified outcome only to do it after, to do it from results produced after a trial began. So you can decide what you were really studying afterwards, which of course is the opposite of pre-registration. And they say their expertise allows them to permit this. He calls it outcome switching, right? And his paper is Make Journals Report Clinical Trials Properly. And I say he shouldn't close his eyes to the possibility that some of the pushback he's seeing has a basis in statistical philosophy of the sort that we just saw in Goodman. And the Vanishing Act, the basis in philosophy, has this technical component. And it's a big disagreement in philosophy of statistics over like 80 years. And that is, if you take an account where the total information or the import of the data is found in the ratio of the likelihood, then the error probabilities will vanish. Now the likelihoods are with X, the data fixed, the hypothesis varied. This is the probability of the data under the assumption of H1 compared to H0. Okay? So this is this technical side to the philosophical different. All error probabilities violate the likelihood principle even if they're not guilty of selection effects. Here's a quote from Dennis Lindley, the Bayesian sampling distribution significance levels, they all depend on something more than the likelihood function. Or the philosopher Roger Rosenkrantz, the likelihood principle implies the irrelevance of predesignation. Doesn't matter if you introduce it after. There's no difference in the information context if you measure information contact by likelihood ratio. So we get this problem with altered error probabilities, not just from biasing selection effects, but also from optional stopping rules. And this is a typical two-sided test. And the difference is, instead of fixing the sample size in advance in some tests, the sample size is determined by a stopping rule. Namely, keep going until you're able to reject your null hypothesis at a 5% computed level, right? And it happens to be known that if you do this, you will eventually stop. It's the proper stopping rule. So if you didn't get a significant result in the first 10, you go to 20, 30, eventually you will. And the actual error probability is altered thereby. But if you follow the likelihood principle, a probabilism, a Bayesian account with exceptions, that won't make a difference. In fact, they make fun of us because we care about trying and trying again, as if we're only picking up something in some researcher's head, his intentions. Okay, so here again, and if you do allow optional stopping, it violates what Cox and Hinckley call the weak repeated sample principle, because you will be wrong with high probability in the long run. Now, here's the burgundy. The American Statistical Association warns correctly that conducting multiple analyses of the data and reporting only those with certain p-values leads to spurious p-values. They don't mean what they're supposed to mean. But what they don't mention in this report is that the same p-hacked, right, data-dependent hypothesis can occur in things like Bayes factors, credibility intervals, likelihood ratios. Instead, you know, they say that some people are fed up with p-values, so they use these alternative methods, but they don't mention the difference. And the big difference is that the direct grounds to criticize inferences is gone, because the grounds are that you flouted your error statistic. But if you're not picking up on error statistics, then it doesn't matter. Now, probabilists might block intuitively unwarranted inferences even though they don't use error probabilities. For example, a subjective Bayesian might say, well, I consult my beliefs and I know that's a wacky hypothesis. And sometimes that can work, such as the hypothesis connecting your being a political moderate and being able to distinguish shades of gray. Right? That sometimes that might be enough, that you could be rescued by your beliefs, but still, now you've got two sources of flexibility, your priors and biasing selection effects, and the whole thing becomes a battle of beliefs, and many researchers do sincerely believe their hypothesis. Further, there's no help with our most important problem, and that is how to distinguish the warrant for a single hypothesis with different methods. We can imagine that one uses biasing selection effects and the other doesn't. I assume if it's the same hypothesis, you'd have the same prior. So there wouldn't be any way to pick up on the difference. Most Bayesians these days do not use subjective priors. They use default priors. It's too hard to elicit subjective priors. Scientists don't want to be subjective. So what are these default priors? And these are prior probabilities on the hypothesis. It's hard to know what that means. But by and large, the idea is to maximize the impact of the data rather than your prior beliefs. And there are many different systems, and they compete with each other. They're not expressions of uncertainty or ignorance. They may not even be probabilities. They're usually improper, which means they don't sum to one. But the thing is that the reforms based on these, they like to call these objective, okay, objective Bayesian priors, but a fairer notion is default. They tout them as free of selection effects. You don't have to know the sampling plan, and this is just one of several, and that's because you don't have to pick up on changing error probability. There are some Bayesians, a few, prepared to abandon the likelihood principle from at least for model testing, and this is Andrew Gelman and Cosma Shalizi, who actually claimed that they're interested in error probes, at least for model testing. The goal being to use modern statistics to implement the Popperian criteria of severe test. So I see it as an open question whether they can do it. Cosma Shalizi is not a Bayesian, but this was a meeting of the minds. Now, to me, the whole American Statistical Association document is really just highlighting classic foibles that we've known about for a long time that block replication. And Fisher told us, in relation to the test of significance, we can say a phenomena is experimentally demonstrable when we know how to conduct an experiment which will rarely fail to give us a statistically significant result. He says, isolated low p-values are meaningless. You have to show me you can bring it about. He doesn't say exactly, you know, how often you have to do it, but clearly the way people are using tests and getting into trouble goes against the Fisherian principles. And the second fallacy of moving from, even if you have a real statistical effect, moving directly to some scientific claim is verboten. And this is Guy Gorenzer, who would say that you need to vary the experiment, repeat it in other laboratories, etc. There's something called null hypothesis significance testing, NHST. Every time I see it, it seems to be allowing this fallacious move from statistical to substantive. Oddly enough, this ASA document also follows this NHST animal and ignores what is called Neyman-Pearson test, which at least prevents some of these fallacies from occurring, because in this account you have a null hypothesis and an alternative that are exhaustive. So when you, even if you do reject the null based on statistical significance, it would only point to evidence in favor of a discrepancy in the direction of the alternative. I mean, I think this needs to be added to, which I do, but at least it avoids some of the fallacies. Admittedly, even with Neyman-Pearson tests, as people complain, what about the effect size? I don't want to just know that you rejected. And I totally agree, this is my commentary again, that we need interpretive tools that avoid fallacies of rejection and non-rejection. So, for example, to avoid inferring a discrepancy beyond what's warranted, called the large N problem, if you have such a big sample size, you may be picking up on a trivial difference. And severity tells us an alpha significant difference is indicative of less of a discrepancy if it results from a larger sample size than a smaller. My analogy is this, the toaster. What's more indicative of a large effect, fire? A fire alarm that goes off with burnt toast, or one so insensitive it doesn't go off unless the house is fully ablaze? And the larger sample size is like the one that goes off with burnt toast. So it's really the insensitive one that is more alarming and should be. This kind of reasoning seems intuitive, and yet many of the uses of tests and criticisms of tests go against it. We also need to worry about fallacies of non-significant results, which a lot of people say we don't know how to interpret them. If you don't find a difference from the null, it doesn't mean there is no difference, no evidence against isn't evidence for, but you can use the same severity reasoning to at least rule out discrepancies that very probably would have resulted in a larger difference than you observed, in order to set upper bounds, okay, as they do in physics and other fields. It's akin to power analysis, if you're familiar with that, another controversial area, but I make them sensitive to the actual outcome. There's another kind of fallacy I definitely wanted to be sure to mention in this group. Behind a reform that's supposed to improve things, but it actually confuses notions from significance tests and leads to the famous Ioannidis, most findings are false. This is some of the replication crisis are fake. I call this the diagnostic screening model of tests. So it goes like this. Imagine randomly selecting a hypothesis, null hypothesis, from an urn of null hypothesis. They say, there's no effect with this, there's no effect. And suppose 90% of those are true. You're to consider just two possibilities, no effect or a meaningful effect, everything else ignored. You're to take the prevalence of 90% true nulls as the probability that the null you pick has 0.9 of being true. Okay, so the probability that there's a meaningful effect is only 0.1. Then you reject the null with a single significant result, and you even do some cherry picking. Then the unsurprising result is most findings are false. This was the Ioannidis result based on much older results, even before Berger and Selke. But what they're showing is that the prevalence of nulls among the group with findings of a p-value of 0.05 is not equal to this number, which is the proper type 1 error probability. So regardless of what you think of these p-values, these two are different, and if you start appraising them as if they ought to be equal, you're really going to get yourself tied up in knots. That is exactly what is happening today in the literature every day. I'm giving this quickly. How did they do that computation? It's a kind of quasi-Bayesian frequentist computation where A is announce a finding of p-value of just 0.05. Not really properly Bayesian. I just finished a paper on this. Not empirical Bayes, not properly frequentist. And by the way, where does this high prevalence come from? This urn with 90%. If you think about selecting what you're going to study, of course, that's not a random selection. Some people say, well, okay, assume 50% are true. Other people say, all nulls, we know they're false already. But then you couldn't get this argument. So a lot of the replication crisis literature uses this computation, which is very questionable. For example, you have that Economist Journal. Okay, good. I wanted to make sure I could say one thing as part of my concluding remark. So first, I totally agree, and I'm glad that we're having this workshop, that if replication research and reforms, if they do correct errors, then it can be very useful to us. But replication research, which is a field of its own now, isn't always geared toward correcting errors. Certainly, many of the reforms are welcome, such as pre-registration, so that you can't just discard unwelcome results that easily. If they control error probabilities and require good design, randomized control trial, checking model assumptions, which you hardly ever hear, but really as the source of most non-replication. Okay, if they don't enlighten us about error correction when they permit or even encourage tools that lack the error control. And that's why I called my commentary, Don't Threat the Error Control Baby. After all, isn't the main source of hand-wringing behind the replication crisis the fact that people selectively report, they cherry-pick, they p-hack, and so on? These biasing selection effects are only going to be picked up by tools that assess error control. Even a performance person, I prefer the severity interpretation, right, the probative one, but even they'll pick up on it, and it's not just because they care about long run. These reforms that are based on probabilisms enable rather than check unreliable result. And that, I think, should be very concerning. I should mention, want to mention one last thing, that replication research has had pushback. This is especially in psychology, and they're calling it replicate. Some are going so far as calling it methodological terrorism. These people are bullying us. And I don't know if you're familiar with this, because, but this is very ongoing, and a lot of people troubled by it. Of course, the way they do the replication research in psychology has some problems. You have these crowdsourced groups that pick a study, like I'm going to pick yours, and I'm going to maybe hopefully find that it doesn't replicate. But my real gripe is that replication, at least in social psychology, really should go beyond the statistical criticism. What they do now is see if they also get a low p-value. And they try to replicate it just the way the original author does. They're supposed to consult with them and so on. But that doesn't seem to be enough. Here's just one example. They're very concerned about being called bullies, but as a result, they tend to construe their non-replications as simply weaker effects. Well, you know, they don't want to charge the original author. So there's nothing wrong there, because they can't really criticize, they say. Here's an example of one that never replicates, it seems, of cleanliness and morality, at least when you pre-register. Does unscrambling soap words make you less judgmental? And this is one of the ones that caused the big ruckus about the methodological terrorism, where the researcher had 40 undergraduates unscramble words. One group unscrambling words that suggest cleanliness, the other neutral words. And then they're presented with a number of moral dilemmas. This is a quote from the Chronicle of Higher Education, like whether it's cool to eat your dog after it gets run over by a car. Turns out it did. The subjects who had unscrambled clean words weren't as harsh on the guy who chows down on his chow. This is from, again, not my words, but the Chronicle. By focusing on the p-values, and then you have people defending her, saying that the replicators didn't exactly mimic her study, but they're not looking at the leap from the statistical to the substantive. As to whether these unscrambling the words has anything to do with feeling clean? I don't know. It's supposed to be some sort of situated cognition. Oops. And interestingly, this kind of study that they use as the basis for experimental philosophy to study morality and ethical dilemmas. And so I hope that philosophers will start criticizing these studies. So, made it short.